Cheerio Cole from Olaiba, South York Island. I messaged you, get a haircut and get a real job.
Hello and welcome to Behind the Sunrise, a podcast show we're doing to celebrate everything that NITV is doing on the 26th of January. And joining me is the beautiful and the one and only Christine Arnoux. Now, I love hearing that song, Party. I want to know what comes to your mind when you hear that song?
Oh gosh, that was written such a long time ago, Belinda. You know, I just feel old now. Sometimes I'm up on stage, you know, singing Party, and I think to myself, you know, is this a situation of like, I wrote it when I was young and it feels really awkward to be singing such a youthful song, or, you know, not that I feel any different, I guess, but, you know, it's a great song. And that opening line, stepping out in my deadly red shoes, you know, it was at a time when it was really about embracing female power, mm-hmm. and youth, and it also the reason why I called the song the first album Stylin' Up was because there was a point as a teenager where saying to somebody, you know, too busy walking around styling up, you know, yeah. wasn't necessarily a positive thing, it was a negative thing. So I wanted to twist it, styling up, and going, you know what, I'm styling up because there's a lot to be proud of, mm-hmm. an absolute lot to be proud of. So, you know, it kind of guided the title of the album, guided songs like Party, which is really about community, you know, embracing community, and really sort of hats off to a community that really got behind me at the beginning of my career. And I wrote the song for my community.
I suppose that's probably why I wanted to play the song, because it would have been a flashback, mm-hmm. in you know, evoking some emotion and memories to it. What was it like? How did you first start out? What was it like for you when you were young and growing up as a teenager and you wanted this dream of being a singer? Where did it start for you?
I guess it started as far back as my primary school principal, Mr. Trevor West. He had taken over from all of the teachers who had gone down to Cairns to do education conference. So he was running all the composite classes at Moby Egg Island Primary School. And he made us do this some creative writing session. He said, "You want your kids to start to write a story about what you're going to be doing in the year 2000." Now, this was 1982, right. So you know the idea of even being a black woman still alive in 2000, when I was raised around a lot of domestic violence, and oftentimes not a lot of hope. So it was hard to sort of put myself in my own future, if you like. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't actually write. I struggled with the idea of writing what I was going to be doing in the year 2000. And so Mr. West came over and he was a little bit puzzled, because he's one of those teachers who had a lot of belief in me. He's, and faith, mm-hmm. you know, a really great teacher who pushed me into doing things that he said, "You can do that. You're amazing." So, and he was just one of those really special teachers who had a really positive influence on me, in the institution of education, and he also did something remarkable, which was he helped me paint a picture of my future and placed myself there. So he said, okay, let's just start with, where are you going to be living? And I shrugged my shoulders, couldn't see myself getting voted off the island at this stage. So he said, okay, you're going to be living in Sydney. How old are you going to be? And obviously, I was going to be 30 in the year 2000. What are you going to be doing for a job? And I said, oh, I don't know, sir. And he said, okay, let's just see. You're going to be 30. You're going to be living in Sydney. And let's just say the Olympics are going to come to town and you're going to be in the Olympics. So all of those things happened. All of those things happened. And it was one of those poignant, very, very important things that happened to me as a child that made me see that all I had to do was place the visual in my mind and it would be able to appear. I'd be able to happen to make that, you know, make
it
happen.
So up in the Straits?
Up in the Straits, up on Little Mobiag Island.
Your school teacher said to you, in the year 2000, yeah, you'll be 30, living in Sydney and a part of the Olympics, and all that happened.
And all of that happened, indeed. And it just said, it spoke to me, like it was one of those sort of fortuitous moments when you're up on stage and I'm so, like they turn off the lights and I'm singing My Island Home. And I'm up on this globe that's, you know, on a hydraulic machine that's been thrust into the, you know, so I'm something like how many metres off the ground, I can't remember. And you just, it's at that moment when you go, oh, my gosh, Mr. West, here I am doing exactly what you said I'd be doing. I'm singing in the closing ceremony of the Olympics. I mean, interpret that however you want to, but it still said to me, I must have been paving my pathway to that very moment from the minute that he helped me write that story.
Have you ever reconnected back with Mr. West?
Oh, he passed away several years ago, unfortunately. He ended up moving to Manangreeta in the Northern Territory, and it doesn't surprise me. This man was always connected to First Nations people and in the field of education. Yeah.
Did he know that you became a singer?
I never ended up having a conversation with he or his family to know whether he realises that that's what he did. Because it would have been a great opportunity to say, I don't know if you remember, you made us do this creative writing session and I hated it. I just could not think of, because everyone was writing about spaceships and you know the Jetsons and all this other sort of stuff, and I was just having trouble seeing that I would even be alive.
Yeah. Well, you know, we laugh at that, but it's actually not funny because that was a reality for you.
It was my reality at that time. But I mean, like you said, how did it all start out for me? It started with a humble man, a humble white fella. Who really took his responsibilities very, very seriously, found a young girl, not with a whole lot of belief in herself, and injected what every person in his possession should do, because their responsibility is to bring a child along and instill in them their ability to be a great person.
I can see that you're getting quite emotional about this.
You know, it's... Well, I guess one of those things is, when I think about it, the opportunity to... never have had the opportunity to tell Mr. West and his family how grateful I am, I guess. But, yeah, I think it's... The emotions actually are still raw because... there's so many little Christine Arnoux out there, you know, whose lives I want to touch with my story.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I'm just the biggest sook on earth. I mean, I always wanted to be. I was one of these singing, dancing children. I loved it. My first experience ever of seeing one of the most amazing, you know, movies for that era. Gosh, I was probably 8 years old. It was my first cinematic experience, taken by my auntie Maya, my sister Helen and my sister Leela, to see the movie Grease with Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta. And that soundtrack completely, it changed my life, you know. I remember mum going out, or dad going out and getting the Grease soundtrack, And my sister and I would play dress-ups and we'd make a show from beginning to end, side A, side B. And Mum would be at the sewing machine and we'd be like, Mum, next song. And she'd be looking up there doing the sewing, but looking up and going, yay. And I remember a very pregnant cousin, Sissy Yaley, sitting there also just giggling and laughing. It was obviously really entertaining because, we would go back inside and Mum would let us dress up in her frocks and in her jewellery.
Stop it.
And in high heel shoes, and we'd come out. And it was an absolute ball. So we were creating our own musical theatre shows, at least I was, from when I was really young. And I mean, Christmases would come around and I'd be putting on Christmas shows for the family and being the artistic director and big noter performing in it as well. So it's always been something that I've wanted to do. But when you're in a remote place, when you're just a little speck in the middle of this big blue ocean, mm-hmm. In the middle of, which is this on this big blue earth planet of ours in the middle of, which is just a speck in this big whole universe, you think it's just a small, I'm insignificant in the whole scheme of things, and I just don't know how I'm going to get off this island.
But to take it back, you know, you're with your sister and you're singing Grease songs that transformed your life, it changed your life. Weren't you just in Greece the other night?
I was indeed.
So
I got
here
to
we
do.
Go again.
I got to, I'm the first Indigenous woman to play Teen Angel, which is the song that is traditionally played by a man, and the song is Beauty School Dropout, and I was in an arena version of this concert version with 600 kids. And the reason why it's only gone across 3 days is because it's held on school holidays,
mm-hmm.
So that they can get as many participants as possible. And I love working with kids. They're, to be a person that can inspire that little mind and, mm-hmm. you know, and do something which I can positively say it's life-changing.
It's just funny how both of those childhood dreams or, you know, that you were speaking about before have both become a reality for you.
Yeah, well, then again, I'm kind of one of these people who just goes after the most impossible thing, you know, like, and I do it with, I do it in mind saying the only person that can make this outcome a bad one is actually me, by not giving it a go. And what have I got to lose is always been my motto in life. What have I got to lose? What could be the worst thing that could happen? There's only two outcomes, yes and no. You know,
yeah.
and you know, yeah. In my industry, you get used to hearing a no a lot. And that's okay. But it doesn't, it's, no isn't saying that you're not good at what you do. And you have to find different ways of keeping that self-belief and a constant stream of encouragement to yourself. It's okay, just get out there and do it. And also, I'll say this to anyone who is thinking, I don't want to do that because I'm scared. Well, you don't grow unless you step outside your comfort zone and you're scared.
What was it like for you? I just want to go back to that time. You're living up in the Torres Strait. What part of the Straits were you living?
Okay, so Kalalagoya language group. So the middle western Torres Strait Islands. It's middle western Torres Strait Islands, yeah.
And you then decided to move to Sydney.
Yeah, well, you have to leave the island to attend high school.
Yeah.
You either go to Thursday Island, to the campus on Thursday Island, or you go further down south to boarding school. So I finished high school in Rockhampton. The last 3 years, I think, or 2 years of high school, my parents uprooted from Mobiag with my three younger siblings and decided to move down permanently to Rockhampton. It was just more opportunity and better opportunities for education, lot more choices. So that was about 1987, and I graduated that day and jumped on on a, I didn't bother about schoolies or anything else that everyone was, it's like, no, I'm on a mish. And I was heading to Sydney to try out for the National Aboriginal and Islander Skills Development Association, which I was put in touch with through our Indigenous liaison officer, mm-hmm. Troy Doyle, who looked after year 11 and 12 in high school. And he said, "What if I could give you a blank canvas and you could tell me the one thing that you want to be doing, hands down, doesn't matter what the answer is going to be, mm-hmm. what is that?" And I said to him, "I want to be a performer." And he said, "Great, I've got this great." So, in fact, my wife and I went to study at this school, and we know all about it. We know how to get the registration forms for you. All you have to do is we'll fill them out together. I'll send it off for you, and you tell us where you want the what address you want them to send the reply to. Mm. And at this point, I was already living with. I'd already come down by train to Newcastle to stay with my sister, and I got the "Yes, you've been accepted to audition" letter, and then it was a matter of investing 5 years of my life into getting an associate diploma, which ended up being a piece of paper that I never really needed to use, because I went from there onto a recording career without even having time to blink in between.
And that was, how quick was that for you? How did you mentally prepare yourself for something like that?
Well, it was kind of really serendipitous, I think, how it happened. I had met one of the girls I was graduating with, who's very well known in her own right, Miss Frances Rings, was really good friends with Neil Murray. And Neil Murray is, of course, one of the Wurrumbi band members who wrote My Island Home for the Wurrumbis. And he was invited by Ningley Lawford, was the other one that was a good friends with him, and Frances, to come along to a May workshop. Now, what happens in a May workshop for the 5 years that we were there is the cultural teachers come from whatever community that we're studying that year. Mm. The cultural elders, tutors come to us from one Aboriginal community, one Torres Strait Islander community. And we spend 4 weeks in rehearsal of language, song, dance, you name it, but just learning everything that we possibly can about this First Nations people. And he was attending the one that we were doing from Yam Island that year, and he turned to Frances and said, "Who's the little girl with the big voice? And tell her to give me a call. Here's my number. If she'd like to come on and do some singing in the band." And that really terrified me, because at this stage I was already going to be graduating as a dancer. I'd lost all the other ideas of doing anything else. I was going to dance. And then it threw me a bit, you know, like it sort of turned around and hit me in the back of the head. I wasn't expecting it. And it's like Frances said, just do it. If you don't like it, you don't like it. But so we spent 2 weeks on Neil's porch in Annandale, learning his songs and lyrics and everything, and where I'd have to come in and sing. And I did my first backing singing in Neil Murray and the Rainmakers at the Sylvania Waters Hotel that year. Now, I couldn't tell the college that I was doing extracurricular, because you had to get permission to do that, and most often you wouldn't be given the permission to do it. So that happened in around about June, July. And by the time December came around, I graduated and got a record deal.
That is amazing.
Just off the back of playing with Neil. But Neil Murray is the person who gave me my first gig as a singer.
Wow, I never knew that. I've never
sung in front of an audience before Neil gave me that opportunity. So I was really still finding my voice as a backing singer / singer by the time the record deal came around in December of 1992.
Was it sort of, did you sort of feel protected knowing that you had Neil Murray and the band in front of you?
He decided that I should get up and sing My Island Home and give him a break in the set.
So is that how that relationship started?
Correct.
With recording My Island Home?
Yes, well, I didn't have... So I've signed the record deal, and I've signed it off the back of no demo. No demo songs, no idea. They have no idea what I can do. They just went ahead and signed me.
And this is a big record label. Back in the day where record labels were everything. This is before Apple Music and Download and Spotify. This is when record
YouTube.
Mm-hmm. This is Vimo. When record companies were huge, weren't they? They were the be-all and end-all.
That's
to
right.
Really, and so a lot of people would spend years trying to get a deal with a record company, and they've signed
you. A lot of people
you.
Spend money doing demos as well, because that you want to give the best, put the best foot forward, that gives them an idea of whether they think that you're a marketable, your music is marketable, and you are indeed marketable.
And so to be signed without a demo back in the day was amazing. Like, that was never heard of, really.
I think so. And so... And so the big boss said to the label manager, we need to hear something. I was with Neil and the Rainmakers at the time cutting an album, and Neil got the phone call from management, because we had the same management by then, saying, you know, would you be able to put down My Island Home? And Neil turned to me and said, look, we're here already. Why don't we just put down My Island Home? And the production was slick. Yeah. I'd been singing it for a while now. Yeah. And by the time we sent it down to Mushroom, to the label, White Records, they went, right, great, this is fantastic. That's her single. And it became my song by default.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have time to write. Yeah. I didn't have time to do artist development.
Mm-hmm.
It was just hurry up, get this out there. So it really sort of helped, in a strange way, guide and define. It became my first child, but it also became this guiding light that would really quickly help me discover the kind of unique artist that I would be, and guide my brand of cultural pride and ambassadorship. You know, I've been since flying my flag for a very long time, and flying it and having the opportunity to educate through music, extend beyond music to my culture. You know, it's been an amazing platform to be able to have the opportunity to do that. And last year, 2017, My Island Home, my recorded version of it, was put into the Australian Sound Archives Museum, and it's immortalised there now as an Australian song to be recognised.
Well, speaking of My Island Home, I'm now going to play, Christine, when you were a part of our anthem sessions last year, and you sang this song in front of the Opera House. It was the most beautiful day. So right now, let's have a listen to it.
The vibe here today performing at this pop-up concert was absolutely magical. It was such a great opportunity to let the public know, firstly, who I am, why I'm here, and let's start the conversation about the 26th of January. What do you think? So it's such a fantastic idea. The reason why I wanted to do a revision of the version of Island Home that I originally did was because it was chosen to represent one of the anthemic songs of Australia, a song that represents what Australia is for all Australians. And Neil Murray rewrote a verse for the Olympics because they wanted to restructure it, make it longer, because the whole song was going to incorporate the flower lifting up and becoming a globe and turning into the world, and me standing on top of the world singing My Island Home. And the idea was absolutely wonderful, and it was just such an honour to represent my people, my family, my community and Australia. The reason I think Island Home has stood the test of time is because the story is so strong. It's about a sense of belonging, as the words say. And though I may travel far across the ocean, it will never forget me, because, you know, we belong to the land, not the land to us. So I think that's why the story is so special in it, and how it resonates with the people right across the country, Australians that live abroad, and how it's really been accepted as an anthem for all Australians. January 26th means a day that we need to commemorate. It's about remembering what happened on that day all those many years ago. It should be a day that's marked with celebration, really, about a treaty, as opposed to a day that has been taken away from Indigenous people. The real history is this is what happened. For me, it's about the history of what happened and honouring that and getting all Australians to understand this is what happened on the 26th of January. And there can be any other date of the year, but, you know, it needs to be celebrated by everyone for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons.
A week of courage.
We all have our own stories.
Strength.
The theft of a country.
And resilience. The first Australian survivors. It's our story. Always will be. This week on NITV.
You're listening to Behind the Sunrise. Our guest for today is Christine Arnoux. We spoke about before when you first left Thursday, the Torres Straits, and moved to Sydney. You're then dancing. Next thing you know, you've got a record deal. We're now in 2018. What's in the middle, Christine, and how have you stayed relevant? How have you got through the struggles, the highs, the lows, which would come with being in the music industry or any sort
yes.
of industry? And amongst all of that, you've had children.
Yes. Well, you're absolutely right. My children are my greatest achievement to date, and I hope that doesn't sound like I'm making something sound so stereotyped, you know, like, but it's true. They are, because there's no accolade for that, but I have had to grow up and make mistakes around them, mm-hmm. and they're still the constant in my life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. And my best fan base, I guess, you know, are my children. But at the same time, they know that they're probably the only people aside from my family who know that mum's just a person.
Yeah.
She's just mum. She's not Christine Arnoux.
Yeah.
She's
yeah.
just mum. Yeah. Mum, our mother is not perfect, and our mother makes mistakes.
That's it. That's right.
And that's where I find that it's a forgiving space, motherhood.
Has there ever been a time when you haven't been working? I mean,
If there was, I think I drove everyone up the wall.
Yeah,
because I'm a pain in the backside when I'm not working.
Is that a low point for you? Was that a difficult? Were there times when it was all you're up here, and then all of a sudden, you know,
it was? Well, of course there was that, and I call them transitions. I think each part you look back on and you think, well, that was actually when I was transitioning into this part of my life, because was the end of that part of what I was doing. One of the first lows for me was when you're not the new kid on the block anymore, and the interest isn't there for you. So, and what I mean by that is not because it's an ego thing, but the work drops off. And when the work drops off, you can't pay your bills. It's harder for your kids to go on extracurricular activities or even maintain that for them, and which is important because they need to do sport and they need to do all of these other things in their lives. And that's where it starts to hurt. But also, you know that time away from what you do, it's really hard to get back up on stage and have the same confidence when you've had a bit of a break after a while. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the main thing that I've struggled with as a performer, is that I am my bar is so high. I strive for perfection all the time. And when I have the biggest doubts in myself whenever I've had a break for a little bit, and it's just... Of course it isn't like that, but I guess that's where the pressure is, mostly from myself.
Do you think, I don't know if it, every time I turn the TV on, you're on promoting something.
Sorry.
that in a really positive way. But you're becoming even more relevant now. Did you think that would happen? I mean, you've been doing so much lately and you have evolved.
Yeah, well, you know, I have evolved and I'm doing a lot more lately because I am an older woman with a lot more to say, my socials in a way that encourages dialogue, changes dialogue perhaps, but it is because we communicate with our world, the world around us. It's global now. It's not just the community isn't small. The community is global, I can communicate and to a whole broad spectrum of people about anything at any time, and I think that's why it's become a very useful tool, given that I know how to use that platform. It's taken me a while, but
I suppose young kids help that too.
Yes.
So, and one of the reasons why, you know, we want to chat with you today and to be on this podcast show is you're our host this year for our sunrise ceremony.
So absolutely privileged and honoured to be, yes.
And you were a part of it last year. What did you take away from that sunrise ceremony?
I took away that it is so important to acknowledge our history. This is the thing I've struggled with in my time as a human being on this continent, in this land, is that we still haven't arrived at what our common history is. I struggle to see it being discussed openly. What happened has happened, I like the fact that my presence is always there on the 26th of January so that we can be reminded and we will never forget.
Mm-mm. You put out a statement last week. Tell us a little bit about that and some of the reaction that you've got.
There was a launch for the 26th of January for the Live at the Sydney Opera House performance, which is the main event this Friday. And for people who may not know, my history with the 26th of January celebrations, or however it is that you choose to want to call this day, it goes back to the beginning of my career when Survival Concert was at LAPA. And that's how I've been in it practically every year, whether it be around New South Wales or around the country. I've always performed on this day. My songs and my stories deserve a stage any time of the year, and especially on that day, because we have survived, our culture has survived, we are resilient people, we are strong people, we are here to continue to tell our stories, and together, as I've done over the years with other Indigenous performers and entertainers on that day, have been on stage because that's what I'm there to do, is to find a platform to always continue our song lines. I'm a very important part in that. However, if we need, just like anything else, when we talk about change, we get scared.
Yeah.
And a lot of things in throughout history came up against a bit of resistance. Change the date. We're ready to move. We're ready to... It is time. We've done a lot of things in our history. You know, Mabo Day. We've done, you know, Reconciliation Day. We've done NAIDOC. We've got all of these things in history that have built a very, very strong nation where we walk side by side with our Indigenous history right there. There's no reason why we can't. It's time. But also moving beyond that, I guess the discussion would need to be, if we moved the date, do we still have an opportunity to discuss what the 26th of January is actually about? The one thing, if we can talk about what colonisation has done, is it's practically wiped out all of our languages. And the important thing, I felt that I was ripped off in high school, going through school, never learning about First Nations people, me as a person and as a family member, never being represented in classroom discussions whenever we come to the history of Australia.
That's exactly right.
I wanted to take that ownership back and say, well, you know what, I now have a mega platform as a commercial pop artist to now say the things I want to say in my mother tongue. And kudos to White Label at Mushroom Records for putting out Monkey and the Turtle and that story first. And I mean, I don't know why they went with that song, mm-hmm. but that it was amazing to hear that song being played on radio.
So Monkey and the Turtle was released by a mainstream record company however many years ago?
Gosh, we're talking 1993, and which was the year of Indigenous people too, by the way. So I don't know if it was a strategic move to do that, but just quietly, there was a thought process that was going on at the time. I mean, they've signed me off of, you know, not off a royally oily rag. I mean, I didn't even have a demo record to give them. Then their first choice as a single is Monkey and the Turtle. I mean, these. Either these guys were really forward-thinking for that time, or they were just like, ah, she's a tax write-off anyway. It doesn't matter what we do with her. Just put it out there.
Always Will Be season continues.
Here's a short history lesson according to Warwick Thornton.
Gonna have to behave yourself.
When Philip came here with the first fleet, they followed the Southern Cross.
The Southern Cross is on the Brazilian flag as well, man.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
It was never taken from us.
Always was. Always will be.
I do not accept that there is underlying racism in this country.
We don't need a map. Thursday, 8 p.m. on NITV.
Well, we've come to the end of our Behind the Sunrise podcast show. It's been great having your company, and don't forget to tune in this Friday morning from 6:30 a.m. on NITV. Christine, always such a pleasure to catch up with you, and thanks so much for sharing so much with us. But before we let you go today, really special treat that I'd love to talk about with you is that you'll be performing with your daughter Zipporah at the Sunrise Ceremony on Friday morning. Can you tell me a little bit about the song that you're singing, Kulba Yade?
It's in Kalakaua language. It means Kulba means old, Yade is yarns or stories. And I wanted to write this song long before mobile phones have taken over our lives. And I wrote this song because I could see fast approaching a day where we would discontinue the sitting down and sharing of stories. Family, this is how we handed down information. We have an oral tradition. We love to sit down and yarn. And so this song, Kulba Yade, is a lament about the possible loss of our oral traditions, the you know, orating, telling, passing down stories from generation to generation. And the metaphor that I use in it is Warupo Yanguwakai is the sound of drums, and that symbolises the sound, the voices of the old people who I usher in their presence to be with us while we think about our old yarns.
Kulbaya daye.
A special event celebrating a story 60,000 years in the making kicks off with NITV's Sunrise Ceremony. Live from North Head, join hosts Christine Arnoux and John Paul Jenke with a guest performance by Baker Boy. Together we share our culture, our experience and reflect on the future for all Australians. The Always Will Be Sunrise Ceremony. Friday 6:30 a.m. and Encore 9:30 p.m. on NITV.